Last week, we kind of finished with Galatians, at least for our purposes in our study, and mentioned that both last week and this morning that we would move toward what is known as the Corinthian correspondence. In the New Testament, we have two letters listed as Corinthians, of course, 1st and 2nd. However, those may not have been the only correspondences between Paul and the church at Corinth. We do know that a little bit of history about Corinth itself. Paul is in Ephesus and he's writing to this particular church that he has visited, that he has helped to start. The city of Corinth was located right on a bay. In fact, if you were to look at the Mediterranean Sea and the Aegean Sea and come around from Macedonia to Achaia, which is Greece, there's a little piece of land that juts out between Macedonia and Greece. And on one side of that, the Mediterranean side, is the city of Cenchreae. And on the other side, located on a very large bay between Macedonia and Greece proper, is Corinth. This little isthmus or piece of ground was only about 3 or 4 miles across between the two cities. And yet Corinth was the larger city and at one point in time was the capital of the entire Achaean League, that is, all the Greek city-states. Corinth was a very cosmopolitan place. It was a place where if there was a Greek god or goddess, there was a shrine, at least one, for each one. Does anyone know which of the Greek gods, however, was the chief god worshipped out of all the Greek pantheon at Corinth? We'll take guesses. You want to take a guess, Ed? Oh, Hera, the goddess of love. And she was the wife of Zeus. Well, you got Hera and you got Aphrodite. Aphrodite was actually... Hera had more to do with war as well as Apollo. But Aphrodite. And you got Zeus, and people might think Aphrodite or Zeus. And actually, you might want to... When we talk a little bit about Corinth, you might eventually think Aphrodite should have been. Dionysus would have been very popular, Susan, but still Dionysus was not the chief god worshipped overall in Corinth. I'll give you a hint, Jim. No. I'll give you a hint, Jim. Corinth was considered a sailor's town. Poseidon. Neptune was the Roman equivalent. Poseidon, the god of the sea. Poseidon. All kinds of others were worshipped, but Poseidon was the chief god. You might wonder, well, why in the world was Poseidon the chief god if Corinth is on this big bay on one side, not even on the ocean? But just to give you an idea, and if you were to look at a map, and maybe, I think there may be some maps in the backs of the... in the back of the Pew Bibles. But if you were to find Macedonia and then you were to find Achaia, you've got the Aegean Sea under Thrace, you've got the Aegean Sea and then the Mediterranean, and you have the island of Crete. The island of Crete is down below Achaia or Greece. say you were to, you're a ship owner, and you're going to come, you're up here at, Smyrna in Asia Minor. And your ship leaves Smyrna, and you're going to send your goods to Rome. So your ship leaves Smyrna up here on the Aegean Sea and would come, and the most direct route that a sailor might think of taking would be between Achaia and the island of Crete. I mean, that's a pretty direct shot. From between Achaia and the island of Crete. That's a pretty direct shot, right? And then on out into the Mediterranean and around to Rome. Little did a lot of folks know early on that there are some very dangerous shoals and currents and waters in that area between the island of Crete and Greece, or Achaia. And the odds and storms would come across the Mediterranean in a heartbeat, very violent storms. And so, you're the merchant, your ship sails from Smyrna. You had less than, historians have figured, you probably had less than a 50% chance of your ship making it through without at least losing some cargo or being damaged if one of those storms comes up and the winds blow you against the shoals and the various reefs. Okay, well, that might ruin your business, so what do? We leave Smyrna in the Aegean Sea and we'll just sail around the island of Crete instead of going between the two. Well, that costs you time and more of a chance of piracy and all those other kinds of issues as well. So what would happen very often is ships coming through from the Aegean Sea, say sailing from Smyrna, would sail right down here to Achaia and put in at Cenchreae. The sailors would have liberty in town, and there were people who spent their lives and the lives of animals and others pulling fully loaded ships out of the water, pulling them on rollers and wagons, etc., across that 3 to 4 mile stretch of land and putting them back in the water over at Corinth. And then you could sail right out of the bay. It doesn't take as long as sailing around the island of Crete. You don't have to worry about your ship running on the reefs between Crete and Achaia. Your sailors get a little liberty in town. You put in here, you come right out of the bay. It's a straight shot to Italy and to Rome. And the Greeks believed that the reason those waters were so dangerous is because they were sacred to Poseidon, and that Poseidon, when ships went in that area, Poseidon got upset and stirred the waters to drive the ships against the reefs. Well, if the sailors are coming into town with liberty for the number of days that it takes to pull those fully loaded ships across that 3 to 4 mile stretch of land. And by the way, there are occasionally some repeats of a program on the History Channel that will show there are still some of the ruts in the stone bedrock across that portion of the world where you can see where they pull those fully loaded ships out of the water and across that stretch of land and put them in on the other side. You can imagine you got all these sailors coming into town and all this business. Of course, you're going to pay homage to the God that you think brought you all that business. So that's why, in large part, that Poseidon was the Greek god that was most worshipped in Corinth. Now, and it was a sailor's town and then some. There were more red light districts in Corinth than stoplights in Greenville County. It was kind of the Las Vegas of, or maybe even worse, of Greece. Prostitution was a major business in Corinth. In fact, the Greek writer and philosopher Aristophanes coined a word, Corinthia zestai, Corinth is at the beginning of that word. The Greek word korinthiazestai means to commit fornication. That gives you an idea of the kind of town Corinth was, the kind of reputation that Corinth had. How would you like for your hometown to be known throughout the world as the seat of fornication? Pretty wild town. Actually, one of the other imported religions that was very important to some people in Corinth was the cult of Isis. Because Isis gave equality to women, and there was a very large female population in Corinth. And it is in Corinth that we find a lot of folks who became Christians, a lot of women who became Christians who were prostitutes, were supported by or given jobs by folks in the church. One of the things that the church did back then, they cared for people who were poor, who were destitute, but they also helped people in the interim period find jobs or be supported. Because if these women become Christians, followers of the way, and therefore they have to give up that former profession, what are they going to do? Well, there were people in the church would actually help them find jobs and do other kinds of things. Social work, social ministry went on in the early Christian church. And Corinth is one of those examples, actually. So this is the kind of town where a lot of mission work to be done. Every Greek god or goddess, some Roman ones, some Egyptian and others, were worshipped and had shrines in and around the city of Corinth. And it's into this situation that a Christian church develops. And a lot of the things that Paul addresses in sections of the Corinthian correspondence are related directly to how do we live as Christians in this kind of setting. Now, I know that's not relevant to today, right? How do we live as Christians in this kind of setting where all of this stuff's going on and all of these other religions are out here, and people say, oh, well, but we can go to this, we can go to the cult of Dionysus this week, and we can go out here and worship at the temple for Aphrodite in this one, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. How do you remain faithful and loyal, and how do you live Christian lives? And it even gets down to how do you live a Christian life in this kind of society and eat the food that's been offered to an idol and then taken next door to the meat market to be sold. There are all kinds of practical questions that Paul deals with in this correspondence over a period of a couple of years, actually. And things that are going on in the church. I know things that don't go on in churches today. Like back then they had this, I figured, Paul says, I heard from Chloe's people that there are divisions among you and there's some fighting among you and all this kind of stuff. I figured Chloe must be a little blue-haired lady that's got her nose stuck in everybody's business. I don't see any blue hair in here. So, yes. And then he talks about different factions warring in the church. So I know that doesn't happen these days, but back then it did. And other kinds of issues. So these are very practical letters dealing with how to live a Christian life in a very metropolitan, cosmopolitan, sometimes very hostile world. Now, when we come to the Corinthian correspondence, when we turn in our Bibles, we talk about reading from 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians. Though those two designations are a little bit misleading. If you recall, we said at the beginning of this study that the letters of Paul are arranged from longest to the shortest, not chronologically. And it is the church, as the letters were gathered together, that labeled them Corinthians Alpha and Corinthians Beta. And And when we come to Corinthians, sometimes, if we really pay attention as we're reading, sometimes it can be somewhat confusing when we read, especially in 2 Corinthians, because there are places where Paul will be going along writing very nice, very conciliatory, everything's wonderful, and the next thing you know, you're wondering if he's a paranoid schizophrenic, because in the next verse he turns around and jumps on them with both feet and chews them out. And then 20 verses later, he turns right back around and continues the same thought that he had going on before. Or in one section, he's very, very much that way, and then he turns around and threatens. You just wait till I get there. I'm coming to see you again, and you just wait till I get there. We're going to get the big switch out. So sometimes, and it may not, but sometimes I think it can help if we look at this, remembering that this is correspondence, long distance correspondence over a period of time, and that when the church gathered letters together, the letters of Paul, the church gathered together letters by length and put them in there, and perhaps, well, let me ask you, if you keep letters, and maybe you don't keep them in the envelopes. Take them out of the envelopes, you read them. I don't know. I'll go ahead and admit, we've got a box about this big in our closet that contains every letter Mary and I wrote to each other from the time we met in June of 1974 until the time the week before we got married in December of 1974. And some of those, most of them are in envelopes because Mary was very organized. Yes, we met in June and got married in December. So when people say, in marriage, can I say, well, how long should we be engaged before? Don't ask me. Don't know. Whatever works. We met in June. I went back for a week in July for a brother's wedding and proposed. I went back for 5 days at Thanksgiving, and she flew down here from Connecticut the day after Christmas, and we got married New Year's Eve. Paid Ma Bell a lot of money over those several months. And spent a lot on postage and that kind of stuff. And I think I've told some of y'all before, I've still got a letter that the group I was singing with when we met, that the leader of that group wrote me telling me that that our marriage would never last, that I'd never have any kind of career in ministry, and that my life would be a wreck if we got married. And I came this close to sending him an invitation to our 25th wedding anniversary along with that letter. But I'm saving it for later. We just completed 34. I'm going to send it later. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know about you. Mary was very organized. I didn't always keep the envelopes. But have you ever kept letters, several letters, and you don't keep the envelopes, and then later you go back to read them, and you start reading, and all of a sudden you read this page, and then you go to this one, or maybe even the same letter, and you read this page, and you get to the bottom, and you go to the top of the next page for the continuation of the sentence, and it doesn't make any sense? Yeah, a few people have done that. I see people pointing fingers at each other. You know, what happened? They got shuffled in over time, right? Or maybe you took them out and then you put them back in, weren't as careful, and they got shuffled in. Well, there are many who think that's perhaps what happened with some of the Corinthian correspondence. Because we know for a fact that 1 Corinthians or Corinthians Alpha was not the first letter written by Paul to the church at Corinth. And we don't guess at that. That's not guesswork at all. We know it because Paul says it in the letter. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, when he is addressing one of those issues, sexual immorality in the church. And he's addressing an issue there that even the pagans don't agree with. a man's living with his father's wife and you're arrogant about it. He's actually in a relationship with his stepmother, not his natural mother. They said even the pagans don't allow that to happen. But when you go down into verse 9 of chapter 5, he said, "Now, I wrote to you in my letter." It's not "I am writing," but "I wrote," past tense, "to you in my letter, not to associate with sexually immoral persons," not at all meaning the immoral of this world or the greedy and robbers or idolaters, since you would then need to go out of the world. "But now I am writing to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother or sister who is sexually immoral or greedy," etc., etc., etc. "I wrote to you before." So Paul's telling us right up front, this is not his first correspondence with them. It's not his first letter that he wrote to this church. So 1 Corinthians is actually the second letter that Paul wrote. He has written a previous letter which deals, among other things, with a very practical issue in the city of Corinth, sexual immorality by people who were part of the church.
Well, why do they let that stand in this 1 Corinthians?
Because the church, when they put everything together, this is an entire unit. All the chapters in 1 Corinthians was one long letter, and since Romans was the longest, it was the second longest, they put it there. Then they put together the other letters that are part of the Corinthian correspondence as another one and label those Corinthians beta. And then they go to Galatians, which is the next longest, and because they're longest to shortest. But, partly in answer to your question, we in the church, quite frankly, over the centuries have not always done a good job of telling folks these kinds of things. Which, depending on age and maturity of the persons in the church, in some instances is okay. However, my personal opinion is that we, clergy especially, have done a disservice to folks in the church by not giving more history of how the thing came to be put together and of how it was written and why and that kind of thing. So, I guess out of my particular background, that's part of why you all get some of the stuff that you do thrown at you. And I used to apologize for that, but I don't apologize for it because, you know, I hope it doesn't offend, but I don't apologize because we need to know that kind of stuff. If you talk to a Muslim, they will know more about the history of the Quran than most Christians know about the history of the Bible. Yeah, if they don't, they can be losing their head and etc. And technically, they can't read the Quran in translation. It has to be in Arabic. But not too many of us read the Bible in Greek and Hebrew. So that was the second letter, 1 Corinthians. But it's the longest of those letters, and it deals with a lot of questions that have come up since the first letter. And unfortunately, some of the same things evidently were going on the second time that he wrote about the first time, and it didn't get straight. Which also says something, Ed. The Corinthian correspondence is one of those segments, Ed, that makes you angry at Paul. Oh, I know, but this is it's one of those that over and over again you can get real angry real quick at Paul for some of the things he says and the way he says them. And yet, even with that in mind, the Corinthian correspondence, what we have as 1 and 2 Corinthians, also shows something about the pastoral care of Paul for the congregation. I would contend that he writes at least four letters that are found in 1 and 2 Corinthians. How many of us, if we wrote a letter, somebody didn't pay attention, we might write them another one dealing with it, and if they didn't pay us any attention, how many of us would keep writing them? Unless they were a family member, and even then sometimes we don't do that with family members. But Paul continues on and on until they finally pay attention to what he's saying. So, this is the second letter. 1 Corinthians. And he deals with a lot of questions that have come up from before. So where is the first letter? Well, some scholars have said, we really don't know, we really don't have a clue. Some scholars have said, well, we might, but we're not sure. And some folks say, well, we've got it in 2 Corinthians, chapter 6. And it's one of those pages that got shuffled out of order. Just for your... you can decide for yourself. Hey, that's fine. But if you go to 2 Corinthians chapter 6, and you start reading as we work together with him, we urge you not to accept the grace of God in vain, etc. See, now is the acceptable time. Now is the day of salvation. We've put no obstacle in anyone's way so that no fault may be found with our ministry. But as servants of God, we've commended ourselves in every way through great endurance in afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, riots, labors, sleepless nights, hunger, etc. Getting down into verse 11 through 13, We have spoken frankly to you, Corinthians, and our heart is wide open to you. There is no restriction in our affections, but only in yours. In return, I speak as to children. Open wide your hearts also. And if you jump down to chapter 7, verse 2, make room in your hearts for us, for we have wronged no one, have corrupted no one, and have taken advantage of no one. I do not say this to condemn you, for I said before, you're in our hearts to die together and to live together. I often boast about you. I have great pride in you. I am filled with consolation. I am overjoyed in all our affliction. We've kissed and made up and everything's wonderful, is what he's saying. Now jump back up to verse 13 again, and this time I'm not going to leave out some of it. In return, I speak as to children. Open wide your hearts also. Do not be mismatched with unbelievers, for what partnership is there between righteousness and lawlessness, or what fellowship is there between light and darkness? What agreement does Christ have with Belial? Or what does a believer share with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are the temple of the living God. As God said, I will live in them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from them and be separate from them, says the Lord, and touch nothing unclean. Then I will welcome you, and I will be your father, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. Since we have these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from every defilement of body and of spirit, making holiness perfect in the fear of God. Make room in your hearts for us. Everything's wonderful. Everything's great. In the middle of that, he has jumped into, all of a sudden, a different tone. With this whole thing of what does light have to do with darkness? What does agreement have to do, Christ with Belial? Believers, unbelievers, come out, be separate, cleanse yourself from every defilement. But you know, he talks in 1 Corinthians about, I've written to you before about being mismatched, a believer and an unbeliever, and being defiled, and you need to separate yourself from those who are sexually immoral, etc. And so there are many biblical scholars who think that what has happened is a part of that first letter is found here in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 14 through chapter 7, verse 1, that dealt with ideas of sexual immorality and being defiled and needing to separate ourselves from those who are that way, and would fit with what he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And that for some reason a part of that other letter has been lost over time. Maybe, maybe not. But while he doesn't forbid ordinary friendships and business relationships, he does in this instance talk about being mismatched, being defiled by that kind of connection and needing to cleanse oneself. And it's stuck right here in the middle of this real nice, sweet, gooey kind of statement by Paul about how they've listened and everything's going along swimmingly. Now, if that's the case, then that would be part of the first letter, and Paul then addresses in 1 Corinthians some of the same questions about sexual immorality, and where he says there in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where he talks about, I wrote to you before not to associate with these people who are defiled, etc. Now, if you look at that, then that would be part of an early letter. Then Paul addresses them again, addressing some of the same issues, and gets kind of harsh in part of 1 Corinthians, quite frankly, in answering some of the questions. And deals in chapter 5 very strongly with this sexual immorality that's going on in the church, even to the point where he says, you need to cut this person out of the church and let the devil have their body, and maybe God will save their souls. If then you take that section out of 2 Corinthians 6, 14 to 7, 1, and you then read 2 Corinthians 1 through 9, chapters 1 through 9 are very wonderful. This whole idea that everything has gone well. When you get to 2 Corinthians chapter 10, all of a sudden he turns again and begins a very vigorous self-vindication, a very spirited defense of himself and his ministry, and some of what he says is a very withering and bitter retort to the people. He's engaged in a very bitter struggle for their loyalty in the church. He talks in that about how some have accused him of being a false apostle. He will talk about how they have raised up others within the church that are the super apostles, who they have put on a level above Paul, who are teaching differently from Paul. But they have accused in this, if you read chapters 10 to 13, they have accused Paul of being deceptive with them and of leading them on, etc. And there are places, for example, in chapter 11, verse 7 and following, that I commit a sin by humbling myself so that you might be exalted because I proclaim God's good news to you free of charge. I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you. And when I was with you and was in need, I didn't burden anyone, for any needs were supplied by my friends who came from Macedonia. So I refrained and will continue to refrain from burdening you in any way, as the truth of Christ is in me. This boast of mine will not be silenced in the regions of Achaia. And why not? Because I do not love you? God knows I do. Something's not quite right in paradise here. Verses 16 and following. I repeat, let no one think that I'm a fool. But if you do, then accept me as a fool so that I may boast a little. When I'm saying what I'm saying in regard to this boastful confidence, I'm saying not with the Lord's authority, but as a fool. Since many boast according to human standards, then I will boast. For you gladly put up with fools, being wise yourselves. Things aren't quite right. In chapter 12, he begins, It is necessary to boast. Nothing is to be gained by it, but I will go on to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a person in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third level of heaven. That's himself. So he starts boasting about what he has done and telling them about that. But in verses 11 and following, he says, well, I've been a fool and you forced me to it. Indeed, you should have been the ones commending me, for I am not at all inferior to these super apostles, even though I'm really nothing. The signs of a true apostle were performed among you with utmost patience, signs and wonders and mighty works. Have you been worse off than the other churches, except that I didn't burden you? Forgive me this wrong. It's not a happy kind of thing here. Here I am, ready to come to you this third time, and I will not be a burden because I do not want what is yours but you. Children ought not to lay up for their parents, but the parents for their children. And I will most gladly spend and be spent for you. If I love you more, am I to be loved less? Further down, verses 19 and following of chapter 12. Have you been thinking all along that we've been defending ourselves before you? We're speaking in Christ before God. Everything we do, beloved, is for the sake of building you up. I fear that when I come, I may find you not as I wish, and you may find me not as you wish. I fear that they may perhaps be quarreling, jealousy, anger, selfishness, slander, gossip, conceit, and disorder. I fear that when I come again, my God may humble me before you, and that I may have to mourn over many who previously sinned and have not repented of the impurity, sexual immorality, and licentiousness that they've practiced. This is the third time I'm coming to you, and any charge must be sustained by the evidence or two or three witnesses. I warn those who sinned previously and all the others, and I warn them now while absent, as I did when present on my second visit, that if I come again, I will not be lenient. Just wait till Daddy gets home, right? Now, there are many who would contend that was the third letter that Paul wrote. And Paige, the reason it's in where it is because what we have is chapters 10 through 13 is shorter than 1 through 9. And if you're doing them longest to shortest, then that would make sense. And that this particular letter, this severe letter, finally worked. First letter, he talks about sexual immorality and mismatching. It doesn't work. Second letter, 1 Corinthians, he deals with that and other questions again. It doesn't work. The third letter, he really gets this harsh tone and threatens them. I'll get out the strop when I get there. And they listen up. And then what we have is 2 Corinthians 1 through 9. You've listened. You're doing well. Everything's going great. We've kissed and made up. Now let's go skipping down the yellow brick road together. Now, I know of plenty of scholars that disagree with that and say 1 Corinthians was the first one, in spite of what he says in chapter 5, and 2 Corinthians is a whole unit as well. And that's fine. It just seems to me that to read, to at least know that there's a strong possibility, or there may be a possibility, that these are several letters out of sequence so that you can then know when you're reading it, well, wait a minute, this is what's going on here. It's not that Paul all of a sudden had a paranoia attack or something else. Years and years ago, to make a little more sense out of what Paul is doing in these letters, and also to see more and more of this idea that Paul didn't just give up on them, but he kept on and on and on, even when sometimes he had to be harsh. Why? Because he cared not only about his ministry and mission, but he cared about that particular church and the folks who were in it. It's a very conciliatory letter, those chapters 1 through 9. Expressing his thankfulness. But it also expresses this idea of true caring about the church. Not the church building, but the church. And how the church related within itself, and then the influence that the church would have on the world outside. And so, this church in this highly metropolitan, cosmopolitan, anything goes kind of atmosphere wasn't always this bright beacon of light, because it still had human beings that were in it. But this church also was a place where folks who were having difficult times in their lives, and sometimes because they were causing them, could come, could band together, sometimes could find people not too nice to them, but oftentimes find others who were just as frail and flawed, who found the same grace from God and would work together in overcoming all of that. It was a place where they knew they could come and find like-minded persons. And where they might not always agree, but eventually, though it took some time, eventually they pulled together in spite of their disagreements and became more unified, not conformity, but more unified in their purpose. It's one of those I know I've run a few minutes over. It's one of those situations where I've told some folks recently, my friend and colleague Bill Leonard, who is the dean of the Divinity School at Wake Forest University, the first year he was dean, and he was being paid well to be dean. There were no students, and there was no faculty. He was given the charge, and he got an admissions director and some other folks. He was given the charge to recruit a good, strong faculty and to recruit students for the following year. And on more than one occasion, I'd be at a meeting with Bill or something or hear him speaking, he'd talk about, this is one of the best years of my life. He said, I'm dean of a school of divinity of a major university in the United States, and I'm having a wonderful time because I have no prima donna faculty and no grumbling students to mess it all up. He said, next year is going to be tough because I'm going to have faculty who will ask all kinds of questions and create all kinds of issues, and students who will be grumbling about various things, including the faculty. I'm sure there were times that Paul probably felt that way about the church in Corinth. You know, before I started this group here, it was wonderful because I was starting a church and didn't have to worry about all these issues. But we do find that Paul did not want to give up. Well, excuse me, he might have wanted to, but Paul would not give up on the church until the church was becoming that which God had called her to be. I didn't leave time for questions tonight or comments. You can think about all that stuff and maybe do them next time. How about that? We'll start out with any questions or comments you have about this intro to 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians. We will not read them in order. We will look at them starting with 1 Corinthians and the questions that they deal with, because quite frankly, 1 Corinthians chapter 5 deals with a lot of the same issue that 2 Corinthians 6:14-7:1 does. But we'll look at some of the other practical questions that are taking place in this cosmopolitan world of Corinth. I thank you for your participation. I thank you for being here and listening to my ramblings, and I hope that perhaps maybe something will piece together as we work together through Corinthian correspondence over the next few weeks. May God grant you peace and grace and patience when your own Corinth seems to be ready to tear you down, so that you too might find a conciliatory tone. No, a loving tone, because of the love and care of God within you. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.